What is the perfect U.S. economy? I'm David Brancaccio in New York. The U.S. and the European economies are growing in tandem, but the U.S. is further into its growth cycle. You can see this by looking at their respective central banks in the last 24 hours. The European one said this morning it's now going to wind down its stimulus program and stop buying extra bonds later this year. So Europe back on its feet, at least. Meanwhile, our central banker is talking about the U.S. approaching the perfect place where the Fed can back off its fussing and tinkering. That said, the Federal Reserve chief would not be drawn on what this Goldilocks-style condition would actually look like. Another mystery, how come U.S. wages aren't going up all that much given all the hiring? Diane Swonk is chief economist at the accounting and consulting firm Grant Thornton.
Chairman Powell is extremely vague on why that's going on. There's many reasons for it, he said, but didn't seem to be worried about it in the sense that, one, he hopes that wages will pick up going forward, but two, the Fed has to deal with the reality that regardless of what's going on with wages, inflation is beginning to pick up, and the Fed has also said it expects inflation to exceed the 2% target by mid-year, mostly because of energy prices as we get into the summer.
Tell you what he didn't seem very worried about is any kind of imminent recession. That seems completely off the table from the Fed point of view.
The Fed rarely sort of wants to send up a red flag and say there is a recession. And in fact, right now, the economy is accelerating, even though it looks like we may be setting the stage to accelerate, as Ben Bernanke said in a Wile E. Coyote moment, off a cliff. That is something many people are concerned about with the trade tensions. Right now, the Fed can only react to where we are. And where we are is the economy is accelerating quarter to quarter and year on year in 2018.
All right, Diane Swonk, chief economist at Grant Thornton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The numbers. In early trading, the Dow is up 68 points, 0.3%. S&P 500 up by a similar percentage. The NASDAQ is up 0.6%. We're waiting to see here if today is the day the U.S. Supreme Court issues what could be a landmark ruling on the ability of labor unions to charge fees to people who benefit from union contracts but who don't want to join the union. In order to afford a modest one-bedroom rental in the U.S., a worker would, on average, need to earn $17.90 an hour. That's according to a new calculation by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. Now, $17.90 is far above the federal minimum wage, which is $7.25. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more.
Here is a list of all the places in the U.S. where someone earning minimum wage could afford to rent a two-bedroom home.
There's no place. There's no state. There's no metro area. And there's no county.
Diane Yentel is president of the National Low Income Housing Coalition.
And in fact, there are only 22 counties out of more than 3,000 where a full-time minimum wage worker can afford a one-bedroom rental home.
By afford, Yentel specifically means could someone manage to pay rent using a third of their income or less. Now, clearly, many minimum wage workers are paying rent. But
they're giving up a lot.
Daniel McHugh is with Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies.
They're spending 70, 80, 90% of their incomes on rents,
leaving very little for anything else like healthcare, clothing, and food. Ingrid Ellen helps direct NYU's Furman Center.
You know, people are doubling up. People are taking on multiple jobs.
And many are also just one financial emergency away from not being able to pay the rent at all. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Not everyone gets a chance to study the economy in school. Anyway, who doesn't need a brush up? Marketplace helps you continue your education in a way that we hope is smart, accessible, and hopefully even a bit fun. Your donation is not only an investment in your own learning, but also in helping us make more people smart about the economy. And that, we think, is good for everyone. To learn how you can help, visit marketplace.org/investors. Thank you. The first game of the World Cup starts in about an hour here. It's in Russia, Russia versus Saudi Arabia. 3 billion people around the world will watch the soccer tournament, including a few Americans, even though the U.S. failed to qualify. But you know who will play their hearts out? Nike and Adidas. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
In the World Cup, most folks just root for their favorite team. But if you work for Nike or Adidas, you're probably hoping one of the soccer teams your company sponsors makes the final. Denise Leon is author of the book, What Great Brands Do.
The World Cup is supposed to be about soccer, but it's really about these two brands,
Nike and Adidas. As the tournament's official sponsor, the Adidas brand and logo will probably be seen more often. It's going to supply the official ball, will equip the referees, volunteers, and ball kids. Jim Andrews is with the marketing consultancy firm ESP Properties. He says 20 years ago, official sponsorship was a huge deal. Today, not so much.
Somebody who's not an official sponsor can still create a real connection with this tournament, with the players, and with the teams.
By, for example, making Facebook profiles of players or selling national teams jerseys on Instagram or Twitter. Adidas spends $80 million to be the World Cup's official sponsor and another $200 million on advertising on the 12 teams it's sponsoring. Nike has 10 teams and is expected to shell out at least $1 billion. Ben Sterner, CEO of the sports marketing firm Leverage Agency, points out that Nike spends a lot on the U.S. national soccer team, which didn't make the cut this time around.
U.S. not being in the World Cup is not good for Nike, and that's why I think Adidas has the upper hand.
Adidas, which this year seems to be focusing on sponsoring celebrity players and hot teams, has dominated soccer for decades. For Nike, the sport presents an obvious growth opportunity. The company's working hard to expand the brand with compelling content and personal stories. Bob Dorfman is creative director at Baker Street Advertising.
It is, you know, the world's biggest sport, so you have to do what you can to make inroads. You probably have to be a little edgier and do something a little more out of the ordinary to stand out.
Like offering snappier slogans and cooler apparel. Nike's still the underdog, but the great thing about competition is you never know who's going to come out on top. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Now, in 1994, the U.S. men's soccer team wowed the world, setting stupendously high hopes for the U.S. team in the 1998 World Cup. Big business ramped up to cash in. And why is World Cup soccer still not at the forefront of American consciousness to this day? That was a reason it all fell apart. Tomorrow, we'll have an interview tied to a public media podcast called American Fiasco. But hope springs eternal. There's news this week that in 2026, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico will jointly host the World Cup, if those countries are still talking. This is the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.